closing argument. Walter Hudson. Pursuing happiness thoughtfully. 8 to 10 weeknights on Twin Cities News Talk. AM 1130 and 103.5 FM.
Tuesday on Closing Argument. You know what that means. Pastor Nathan Roberts in studio to give us the progressive Christian perspective on the issues of the day. And we are going to be talking about the news of the day, at least for the first hour tonight. We do not have a second guest until 9 o'clock. At 9 o'clock, we're going to be bringing in Dr. Ulysses W. Burley III. And I understand that's exactly what he goes by, Dr. Ulysses W. Burley III. It sounds like a elementary school is inevitably going to be named after this guy.
Oh, definitely.
So I'm looking forward to meeting the namesake of an elementary school at 9 o'clock. He wants to talk to us about, and so does Nathan as well, and so do I. I think it'll be fun. Toxic masculinity. Boy, oh boy, that's going to be a good time. I don't know if you guys are ready for me and how... You thought I was bad with capitalism last week in terms of getting after you. We start talking about toxic masculinity, the gloves are going to have to come off. So it's going to be fun after 9 o'clock. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We are here 8 to 10 weeknights. Appreciate you joining us. You can be part of the conversation, 651-989-5855. You have a better chance of squeezing in your comment this hour than you will after 9 o'clock, simply because there's only two of us in the room as opposed to the three that we'll have past that point. Nathan, it's great having you back. I got to tell you, you know, the kind of a status update on-air production meeting regarding these little visits we have. I get feedback every time you come on, and it's
overwhelmingly positive.
here's the honest truth. It's increasing in its intensity, but I don't know how it balances out, because I get everything from I can't stand it when you have that filthy commie on the air to I really appreciate what you guys are trying to do and the attempt to try to understand a position that you disagree with. So it's across the spectrum from, you know, I please stop to more of that, right? So I don't know. I don't know what the net result is. We don't have very good audience tracking here on the program. At least they don't make me aware of it.
Is Nathan more or less hated than Bruce Springsteen?
Yeah, did you see that? Yeah, we got a message. We got a message on the back end of our Facebook page about Brad choosing to play Born in the USA yesterday, and it was this thesis on how Bruce Springsteen is a filthy commie and why are we playing his music.
Listen, Nathan is one thing, but I don't care the political views of the musicians that I choose to play for bumper music. Because if I worried about the political views of most musicians, there would be no music to play. We'd only be playing, like, what, Kid Rock and Ted Nugent?
One of the best things about being a liberal is that there is so much music available to you.
Oh, yeah. You can watch or listen to anything. There's no political limitation.
And we don't need conservatives being the PC police on the side of things already.
All right, so I want to take advantage of this opportunity we have this hour to actually talk about things that are going on in the news with you, Nathan, because, you know, we've typically, as of late, our episodes together have been focused on topics. And of course, we're going to get into a topic here after 9 o'clock. The local news that is of note out of the Star Tribune regarding the Mohammed Noor trial, which is taking place right now. Of course, listeners will recall that Mohammed Noor is the Minneapolis police officer, Somali, who was involved in the shooting death of Justine Damond. And, involved. Boy, is that a euphemism. He shot and killed Justine Damond, and now he is facing charges as a result. That trial has begun. The news out of the Star Tribune, in a reversal, Hennepin County judge ruled Tuesday that the public and journalists will be allowed to view body camera video introduced as evidence in the murder trial of former Minneapolis police officer Mohammed Noor. Hennepin County District Judge Catherine Quintance previously decided to shield what she deemed sensitive footage from media and public attending the trial, expressing a desire to protect the privacy of the victim, Justine Damond, and her family. A coalition of local media outlets and open government groups, including the Star Tribune, filed a motion last week challenging the judge's plans as unconstitutional and a violation of common law access to an open trial. On Tuesday morning, just before open statements and the trial began, Quintin said she was bound by First Amendment case law, which favors the coalition's argument. So we're going to get to see this video footage. Now, my understanding is, and they go on to report here, that the video does not include the actual shooting. Apparently, it just includes the aftermath. I don't know why that is. I don't know why the cameras weren't on during the incident in question. I don't know how much use or utility that footage is going to have, but we are going to see it, and you can bet that when that happens, we'll be talking about it here on the program. Nathan, your hot take on this case, the fact that it's now going to trial, this decision by the judge, body cameras, whatever angle you want to take on it. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that this trial is in many ways working the way that police-involved shootings should work. Relatively quickly after someone was shot and killed, the person was taken off the force. There was a public conversation about what to do about it. The mayor was involved. Things proceeded quickly. There was a general trust that there was going to be a process. And what I find interesting is that when it's in a wealthy neighborhood and there are a lot of wealthy, many white, well-connected people that live in a neighborhood, and the victim is a white person, the narrative around this murder, especially right afterwards, I'm going to say murder, but I guess we don't know for sure, was not one of continually questioning the victim in the way that we see with Philando Castile or with Jamar Clark. And I don't want to equivocate all those cases.
Yeah.
But when I was protesting with Black Lives Matter in North Minneapolis at the 4th Precinct, it took weeks of people standing outside the protest to get a process really even started. And I think we've come a long ways where people are now expecting there to be something to happen.
So I think it's really difficult to try to have an apples to apples comparison in cases like this, because certainly I agree with you that the racial dynamic, the role reversal of the racial dynamic in this, particularly given the fact that the officer in question is Somali, is black, and the victim is white and female, there's no question that that has a role in how people perceive it. No doubt.
Yeah.
That said, setting those identities aside, the facts of the shootings, like if you want to compare to Philando Castile, or you want to compare who was the other one? Jamar Clark. Yeah. Jamar Clark in particular. I mean, the circumstances are just so different in terms of what was happening and what the actual interaction with the police was at the particular moment that the shooting took place, that it's really difficult, at least in my view, to sit there and say, well, this is treated this way because she's white and he's black versus when it was the other way around, just because the circumstances are so different, which is not at all to discount the fact that there is a racial dynamic in play. There's no question about it.
Yeah, I would say that for sure the public narrative was different. No one said, no one accused the woman of jumping out and scaring the officer. No one accused the officer of being afraid.
Well, Nora's taken that claim that
the public was not buying it.
Right.
Because people largely are not afraid of white women who teach yoga. And I'm not saying that to diminish the person whose life was lost, because it's a tragedy and justice should absolutely be served. I think that the process that we're seeing now is the process I would like to see in all trials. And I wouldn't, and I hope that it doesn't require protests to set a process like this in motion.
Well, I mean, in the not to pick too many nits, but again, it's hard to have an apples and apples comparison when you didn't even have trials in those other, in the Philando Castile case you did, but in Jamar Clark particularly, to draw the connection between your previous protest activity and this situation, they never even went to trial because there wasn't the evidence there as determined by the Hennepin County attorney.
But they've changed the rules in Hennepin County that they don't solve these things by grand jury anymore. Now they are going to trial. And I also think that politically,
Well, the Hennepin County attorney is going to decide whether or not to take it to trial. It's not that they just automatically go. I mean, you're not going to charge a guy when you don't have evidence to charge him with, right?
My feeling, though, on the case generally is that people have more faith in the system when it comes to a white person being killed in a wealthy neighborhood than when it is a poor person of color shot in a neighborhood primarily of people of color. There's a sense that they don't feel like justice is going to be served in that situation.
Well, grand juries are still being used for police shootings. There was one called for the Justine Damon shooting.
All right. Well, there you go.
This is according to 5 Eyewitness News.
Okay. Thanks for the correction.
So let's move on to what's going on at the border. CNN reports that Trump is pushing to close the El Paso border and told administration officials to resume family separations and agents not admitting migrants. That's quite a choppy headline. President Donald Trump has been pushing to reinstate border family separation policies and sought to close the U.S.-Mexican border at El Paso, Texas, as his conflict with outgoing Homeland Security Secretary Christian Nelson reached a boiling point. 3 Thursdays ago, in a meeting at the Oval Office with top officials, including Nelson, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, top aides Jared Kushner, Mercedes Schlapp, and Dan Scavino, White House counsel Pat Cipollone, and more, the president, according to one attendee, anonymous, of course, was ranting and raving, saying border security was his issue. Senior administration officials say that Trump then ordered Nelson and Pompeo to shut down the port of El Paso the next day, which would have been Friday, March 22nd at noon. Now, this obviously did not happen. The plan was that in subsequent days, the Trump administration would shut down other ports. So apparently, according to this report, there was intentions being aggressively pushed within the administration from Trump himself on down to just start closing legal ports of entry late last month. Nelson told Trump that would be a bad and even dangerous idea and that the governor of Texas, Republican Greg Abbott, had been very supportive of the president. So in other words, what she was trying to tell Trump is you're putting your allies in a bad position, Greg Abbott, your ally, by closing down the legal port of entry to his state. She proposed an alternative plan that would slow down entries at legal ports. She argued that if you close all the ports of entry, all you'd be doing is ending legal trade and travel, but migrants will just go between the ports. Which, to me, this is the interesting thing. This is where I want to get your take on this, Nathan. Because that argument, which I imagine you would tend to agree with, right? That if we shut down the legal ports of entry in an effort to stop the tide of illegal immigration, we're kind of missing the point because illegal immigration isn't taking place at legal ports of entry, certainly relative to the space between those legal ports.
Well, and I'm certainly for the position that we have historically offered people trials for asylum when they attempt to legally claim asylum or refugee or immigrate. And because we don't have a working process, and the administration doesn't seem to be interested in creating a working process, this idea of shutting things down, it feels like putting your finger in a dam, you know?
So I see a parallel here between the approach the administration was looking at taking. They haven't done this, obviously, but the approach they were looking at taking to immigration and legal ports of entry, I see a connection between that and the way that gun control advocates seem to approach the issue of guns, where it's, let's crack down on the legal ways people obtain, purchase, transfer, and utilize their firearms in an effort to stop bad things happening that criminals do, regardless of what the law is. It seems to be a similar approach that the Trump administration was taking to immigration here.
I think it's nonsensical. I think that there's something to be said for the we ban guns on these premises as a sort of a statement about how you feel about guns.
I went to a place of business. I won't throw them under the bus here today, but they had a sign alongside the "We Ban Guns" sign, which you don't even like. You block those out of your perception at this point because everybody's got them. They had another sign that said, "This is a violence-free campus," and all I could think of is I'm picturing in my mind like a guy girded for war full intent on going in and having a workplace violence situation, and he marches up to the door and he reads that sign, and then he just kind of his shoulders sloop and he just sort of slowly walks away. Dum-da-dum-da-dum.
No,
well, I guess I can't do violence here.
I mean, I think it's fine to say as sort of social signaling that you're anti-guns or whatever.
Right, but I mean, as opposed to all the places that are like, woohoo, let's have Wild Wild West in our corridors.
I'm going to a wedding in Texas next week. We'll see. I don't know. I definitely think one of the things I do think that's really important is that we need to have a conversation about immigration and come up with a plan, and all these putting band-aids on points of entry and separating families, which is wildly unpopular and inhumane. This is all what happens when you don't have a plan. You just keep putting band-aids and duct tape on everything.
I want to expound upon that when we come back, because I have a thought, and I'm interested in whether or not you agree with it or have a different perspective. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Pastor Nathan Roberts in studio with us. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Has this bumper music been approved? Is it fair trade or whatever we're going to call it? It's equal opportunity or politically neutral. I don't know. I don't know what qualification we need for our bumper music, but apparently we need some at this point. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Talking with Pastor Nathan Roberts in studio. We're going to be having another guest, Dr. Ulysses W. Burley III, at 9 o'clock to talk about toxic masculinity.
And healthy masculinity.
I hope you guys are ready, because
you know, I did a detox diet all day so that you can just spray your toxicity and it'll just slide right over me.
Is that how it works? You eat vegetables and you grow like a shield against
That's actually what the vegan diet is.
I got you. All right. So let's talk to Dom in Maple Grove regarding Christian Nelson. Dom, how's it going?
Yeah. Hi, Walter. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I gotta disagree with you a little bit about the analogy that you were just making a minute ago about Democrats' issue on the gun control and then the Republicans' issue on the border. I mean, I can see where we can draw the parallel, but my problem with that is, you know, Democrats, whenever they bring up an issue like that, that's kind of like pushing it out of sync all the time. They seem to get away with it. You know, I mean, you know, take a look at what happened banning bump stocks. You know, that's one of the things that they successfully let me quickly finish this analogy here. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but as far as the immigration is concerned, we've been trying to do this for almost two decades. So I'm not saying it's the best solution to, you know, close all the legal borders and stuff like that. But looks like most people, you know, good-meaning people on the conservative Republican side have lost control of the whole situation. Trump is trying to say, to heck with this. They got to try something is where he's coming from.
Right. And but I mean, you got to try something is a really crappy premise for public policy, right?
I understood that.
You know what I'm saying? That. And
but we've had two decades of it. That's what people.
No, I get it. I understand the frustration. You don't have to justify the frustration. I get it. What I'm saying is governing from frustration is not a good idea. And the comparison that I'm making, it's what I'm trying to say is you know, you bring up bump stocks.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever we talk about gun control, as conservatives, we recognize that any law you craft in order to curtail what is legal is not going to have any effect whatsoever upon criminals who don't care what the law is, right? Like, that's what we're always saying whenever we get into these Second Amendment conversations. And I think that the premise there is correct, right? You can't legislate your way to greater compliance, right?
Yeah, so, I completely agree with you. But the problem, the challenge with that is, the Constitution does not ever seems to bind the Democrats into doing things that they want to do. And Republicans say we so firmly adhere to that, which is what we need to do as a nation. But, you know, Democrats, I mean, I don't want to say all Democrats, but at least the liberals of late seem to get away with, you know, damn the Constitution. We'll do what we want. And they seem to be getting their way a lot of places. That's the frustration most people are having.
All I'm suggesting.
Does that make sense?
I understand what you're saying, but what I'm saying is something that seems to be separate from that, which is that the effect of closing down legal points of entry. Now, you know, we're kind of, this is an academic debate because he didn't do it, right? But the fact that he was thinking about doing it is concerning because the effect of having done that would have had no effect whatsoever on illegal immigration. What it would have done is put a stop to people who have the legal right to move back and forth between this country and another. They would have been kept from doing so. Trade would have been cut off. It would have been ridiculous and it would have no positive effect whatsoever.
Which also begs the question, if you want to close legal immigration, what is it really about? Is it about immigration or is it about the nationality and culture of the people who are coming?
So I'm not going to take that bait because we don't have enough time in this segment, but I do want to throw this premise at you and get your thoughts on it, because the fact that this conversation allegedly took place within the Oval Office, whereby Trump was suggesting that not only should we close down the legal points of entry at the southern border, but he was also advocating that we just shut down the asylum processing function, that we're just going to tell people no without any sort of due process whatsoever. And his advisors, many of whom are now leaving the administration as a result of these conflicts, allegedly, were telling him, listen, we can't just decide that we're not going to follow the law. The law provides for an asylum process. The law provides for people being able to move back and forth, you know, if they have the lawful ability to, and we don't have a legal basis for doing this. And his answer, according to these reports, was, I don't care. Now, setting that aside as to, you know, how you feel about that, the point that I'm interested in exploring with you, Nathan, is that it seems to me that on both sides of this debate on immigration, we have gotten to a point fueled by the frustration that Dom points out of 20 years of the law not changing on, you know, where people on both sides of the issue have no sense of respect for the law whatsoever and are just saying, I don't care what the letter of the law is. I don't care whether Congress can pass something. I just want what I want. And if I can get it through executive fiat, fantastic. If I can get it through judicial fiat, fantastic. Doesn't matter. And the system is breaking down as a result.
I think that if you can't get something through Congress or through the process, you don't get to just do it.
We agree.
So if we're all in agreement on that, I think part of it is that we got into this cycle as a country when we had the Obama family meetings where something would happen and then Obama would come out to the Rose Garden, explain what happened. And then he would lay out four or five or six things that he wanted Congress to do.
Uh-huh.
Congress would do nothing.
Uh-huh.
And then we would have a national conversation for like 5 or 6 weeks. We'd see a CNN report and then there'd be a 60 Minutes and everybody would be talking about it, whether it's healthcare or gun control or whatever. And then Obama would come back 6 weeks later and issue an executive order. And we got kind of used to that process. And actually, Congress became somewhat codependent with that process because it looked like something was happening without them having to do anything.
Right.
So they also kind of liked that process.
Absolutely.
And what it bloated the executive office and kept Congress's hands clean. What's happened now is that this process is working, trying to work again, except for Trump is not as good at it. And he's pretty sloppy at the executive order thing. His phrasing of it is all wrong. And so when he gives an executive order, there's not a general sense that, well, at least something happened or it was legal what happened. It's just, he just says things and they're like, your executive order isn't a thing that can happen.
Yeah, I kind of get the spirit of what it is that you're getting after there. It's kind of a executive order now, let's shoot first, ask questions later mentality to executive orders.
But it's not an executive order. It's just him saying something that he wants to happen.
Sure. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, Pastor Nathan Roberts in studio, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
thought that music mattered. But does it bollocks? Not compared to how people matter.
AM 1130, 103.5 FM, closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We are here 8 to 10 weeknights. Appreciate you joining us. We have Pastor Nathan Roberts in studio with us. We're going to be joined in just a little under a half an hour by Dr. Ulysses W. Burley III, who's going to talk with us about toxic masculinity. And with a name like that, I know his masculinity is far from toxic. I'm confident of that. So,
such a gentle soul.
Such a gentle soul, as evidenced superficially by his name. So, long before we get to that, I wanted to touch back upon the Mohammed Noor thing real quick, just because you and I have been having some interesting off-air conversations during the breaks, and we tripped upon an area of passionate disagreement, and that has to do with the rules of engagement that police utilize when they find themselves in deadly force situations. Now, If I'm recapping properly, and correct me, well, let me just ask you to rephrase it. What's your position in terms of what types of rules or circumstances police should be proceeding under when they find themselves in a situation that could escalate to the use of lethal force?
Yeah, I think that I'm definitely much closer to the not having police officers carrying guns around with them.
Oh, so we want bobbies.
I mean... I think the other thing is that we have a multi-tiered system where people are tried through juries. People are not allowed to be executed on the street. We have criminalized public lynchings. And I'm not saying that it's the same.
Well, then why even bring it up?
Because I'm getting there.
Okay.
But people are protected against being tried on the streets. And because a police officer feels afraid, that fear may be coming from a lot of places. Could be post-traumatic stress disorder. Could be an implicit bias they have against certain races and genders. It could be they've been working a 14-hour shift and they're overworked. It could be a lot of reasons. But the civilian should not have to bear the burden of that fear. And so often, in these lethal force cases, the justification is predicated on the police officer felt unsafe. And if a police officer is going to pull out their weapon and threaten a U.S. citizen, they better be ready for legal ramifications.
So there's a nugget in there that I think we could find some amount of agreement on, but let's deal with the disagreement stuff first because it's more entertaining. The notion that people are getting executed in the streets, and I know you qualified it by saying that, oh, I'm not saying that this is what's happening, but you did bring it up. Don't we recognize, or shouldn't we recognize, that there is a qualitative difference between the interaction that takes place between a police officer and literally anybody who they encounter on the street versus the interaction that takes place between a defendant and a jury and a judge in a courtroom? I mean, to my mind, The idea that police officers are like Judge Dredd and they're walking around as judge, jury, and executioner and determining you're guilty, therefore I'm going to shoot you. That's not how these things are going down. What's happening is officers are acting rationally according to the use of force continuum, which dictates that if somebody is coming at you somebody's coming at you with a knife, you come at them with a gun. If somebody's coming at you with a gun, you come at them with more guns from different angles and more people. Like, the idea being that the police should not be going into engagements with a chance to lose. They should be going into engagements with overwhelming force that's going to neutralize the situation as quickly as possible and minimize the threat to public safety and themselves. And what I'm hearing from you is that it should be more of like a kind of a pistols at dawn or dueling at noon type scenario where we make sure that it's a fair contest between the perpetrator and the cop.
No, it shouldn't be a conflict. We shouldn't get to the point where we have these super escalated conflicts. And I think part of the reason is there is a warrior mentality that's deeply entrenched in the training of our police forces. There is an us versus them mentality that has been ingrained in many of the ways that police are being trained. Now, not all, but I have seen certain police precincts that do a really, really fantastic job. The Columbia Heights Police is an amazing police force. They implemented a lot of the Obama recommendations for 21st century policing. Their police officers are big brothers, big sisters in the schools, in the public schools.
Mm-hmm.
They mentor kids of color. They're visible. They spend a lot of time with the community. They hold a lot of forums. I'm not saying that they're perfect and they don't, but they take implicit bias and anti-racism trainings. And the interactions that people have with the police in Columbia Heights is different than the interactions that people typically have with the police in Minneapolis, where I live. I think that in Columbia Heights, they're coming from more of a alongside the community rather than a above and quell the community.
But these incidents don't take place between police departments and their communities. They take place between specific police officers and specific perpetrators who are engaged in specific behaviors that require a specific response.
I think that's a reductive way to look at policing.
It's a specific way to look at policing, but continue.
I said what I said. I think that a part of it is that there is longstanding conflict in some of these neighborhoods between police and neighbors. And those longstanding conflicts spill over into specific interactions. That's how cultural disagreements and longstanding feuds between communities develop.
So, I mean, we do have this reasonable person standard that's employed in the determination of whether or not charges are warranted in a police officer involved shooting. And my understanding, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a cop, but my layman understanding of the standard is that if your hypothetical, middle of the road, average, well-trained police officer reasonably could have taken the same actions that the would-be defendant officer in a particular case is alleged to have taken, then they are not guilty. There's no basis upon which to pursue charges because they acted reasonably and rationally given the training, given the state of the law, given their position as an officer. And one of the things that we were talking about during the break that I found fascinating is, you know, what I see as the ideal is I agree with you that there ought to be real consequences for making real mistakes, right? There ought to be real consequences for abuses. Both negligence, mistake, and abuse should have real severe consequences.
Absolutely.
However, what I don't want to see is I don't want to see officers in scenarios where they reasonably should react in a certain way, up to and including lethal force, and they're hesitating and second-guessing themselves, potentially resulting in the death of themselves, a fellow officer, or a member of the public, because they're, instead of thinking about their tactical situation, they're thinking about their legal situation.
So I think that part of it is I think we really need to think carefully about exploring non-lethal force in police action. Shooting sandbags at people. Doing things that, you know, even tear gas. I know it's very, I don't love the idea of tear gas, but something like that, that neutralizes situations rather than kills people. I just don't understand why a police officer needs to show up and kill someone. It doesn't seem necessary. And this isn't a war. They're not in a wartime between their neighborhood and the police. And so if you're taking out your gun and they should at least feel as worried as any individual is about if you take out your gun and point it at someone else, there's going to be legal consequences for that as citizens. And I think the police officers should be held to a similar standard, not the same, but if a police officer is going to point a gun at a citizen, that should be reviewed.
All right. 651-989-5855. Pastor Nathan Roberts in studio. My name's Walter Hudson. Closing argument, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Hudson's News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, Pastor Nathan Roberts in studio. Very short segment at the end of the hour here. Momentarily, we're going to be joined by Dr. Ulysses W. Burley III to talk about toxic masculinity. We already have a caller on the line ready to comment on that. Let's at least establish the topic first before we take a call. Appreciate you jumping the gun on that, but we'll get to you as soon as we can. I want to finish up this conversation we've been having with Nathan prior to our second guest coming in. Now, I wanted to touch upon this feud that has flared up on social media between Ilhan Omar, our newly elected congressional representative here in Minnesota, representing the 5th District, Minneapolis, and your personal congressional representative, Nathan, who is taken to calling Stephen Miller, a White House advisor to the president, a white nationalist. The report from Vice News, President Donald Trump may not believe that white nationalism is a growing threat, but Democratic Representative Ilhan Omar thinks he has one in his ranks. Omar tweeted Monday that Stephen Miller, one of President Trump's top advisors, is a white nationalist. Legit, illegit? Is she off the reservation on this one? What do you think there, Nathan?
I definitely think that it is one of the cases of there are a couple different definitions of something like white nationalism floating around, particularly in conservative circles and in centrist circles, in circles where people don't really pay attention to politics, and in progressive circles. And I think from a progressive definition of white nationalism, which is that white culture is superior, that minorities, racial, ethnic diversity is diluting what makes America special, that white culture is under threat, it's kind of hard to argue that Stephen Miller is arguing or signaling in that direction a lot of the time. Now, when the point was made up, well, he's Jewish, I think there's a valid question to be had about whether Jewish people are part of white culture or a subculture.
So it's a very fascinating line of discussion that we're not going to have time to fully explore. But just before we go there, it's interesting to note that in this Vice News article, at no point did they acknowledge that Stephen Miller is Jewish. And in the conservative reporting on this exchange from Ilhan Omar, of this tweet from Ilhan Omar, they heavily stress the fact that Stephen Miller is Jewish. I think Donald Trump Jr. put out a tweet to the effect of, you know, shaming her and saying once again from the anti-Semitic Ilhan Omar, we get a attack against a Jew, calling him a white nationalist. How absurd. And, you know, people are going to engage in their kabuki theater on an issue like this. But to your question of, do Jewish people count as white? It is fascinating, isn't it? You know, we were talking about this a little bit before we came on the air tonight. You look at somebody like, say, a Seth Rogen, comic actor, successful, enjoys the privilege of wealth, the privilege of Hollywood and celebrity. Very Jewish. He's obviously Jewish. It's been a huge part of his personal identity and how he's portrayed himself in film and in Hollywood. But also a white guy. He qualifies as both.
Mm-hmm.
So in what context does he get to be a minority? And in what context is he just part of the patriarchy and part of the toxic masculinity that we're about to talk about here?
I'm not here to exactly diagnose Seth Rogen, but I definitely think that you can be part of more than one group. You can be white and rural and white and urban. You can be white and wealthy and white and poor. And I also think that I personally think you can be Jewish and advocate against other racial minorities in a way that heavily favors the white race in some pretty toxic ways.
There you go. There's your controversy for the end of the hour. We're going to leave it there and come back on the other side with Dr. Ulysses W. Burley III regarding toxic masculinity. Get your detox ready, whatever form it takes. 651-989-5855. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Closing argument, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Twin Cities City's News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, Closing Argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We are here 8 to 10 weeknights. It's great having you with us. You can join the conversation, 651-989-5855. Willing to bet you're going to want to. It's going to be a provocative topic here this hour. We have Pastor Nathan Roberts in studio with us. On the line, we welcome Dr. Ulysses W. Burley III. He operates as an independent consultant on the intersection of faith, health, and human rights under You Be the Cure, where he is the owner. He has spoken to the UN and served as a member of the United States Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS under the Obama administration. Perhaps our most highly credentialed guest we've had on the program. I don't think that's an exaggeration.
Richard Painter.
Maybe
he was Richard a White Painter. House
that's
advisor.
True. That's true. He was in the George W. Bush administration.
Ethics Council, yeah.
Ethics Council, something along those lines. So every once in a while, we get a true big wig on the program tonight.
All liberals.
And that's true. We have a hard time securing the big wig conservatives. We're gonna have to look into that. Welcome to the program, Dr. Burley. Appreciate you joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So we're gonna talk about toxic masculinity, a pet peeve concept of mine. And you know, before I dig my heels in too deep, I want to make sure that I understand what it is that I'm reacting to. So I'm going to turn it to you, Dr. Burley, to set the stage in terms of what it is that we're even talking about when we hear this term or utilize this term, toxic masculinity.
Sure. So there are people who do this work exclusively who can explain it much better than I can. Terry Coopers, who is a researcher, and gender studies, defines toxic masculinity as the constellation of socially regressive male traits that serve to foster domination, the devaluation of women, homophobia, and wanton violence. And so that is how Terry Coopers defines toxic masculinity, as someone who exclusively studies toxic masculinity. I'll give you another definition by the Good Men Project. They define it as toxic masculinity being narrow and repressive description of manhood, designating manhood as defined by violence, sex, status, and aggression. It's the cultural ideal of manliness, where strength is everything while emotions are weakness, where sex and brutality are yardsticks by which men are measured, while supposedly feminine traits, which can range from emotional vulnerability to simply not being hypersexual, are the means by which your status as a man can be taken away. My definition for toxic masculinity is simply a masculinity that is restricted to aggression, dominance, power, a masculinity that does not allow for emotion or feeling or empathy or sensitivity. And it's a masculinity that does not account for the whole. It's just a type of masculinity, which is where I think the discussion kind of gets convoluted. When people say toxic masculinity, I think people receive it as this broad brush of painting all men as being violent, as being aggressive, as expressing our manhood in a way that is dominant or overbearing, and therefore toxic. I think you have just cause to have specific feelings around this characterization of toxic masculinity, and I think the experts would agree with you.
So I think the reason why, I mean, you cite the fact that people tend to take it as an attack against all men. I would argue that the reason why they do is because we're using the word masculinity, and that is a reference to men and manhood and maleness and how we define behavior typical of men, and to put the adjective toxic in front of it and say, let's have a conversation about this. It strikes me as a type of engagement and discourse that would never be accepted in virtually any other context. So, for instance, if we were to flip the script and say, let's have a conversation about toxic femininity. Let's go down the list of undesirable traits that tend to be exhibited by women in various contexts. And by all means, we're not talking about all women, but we need to have a serious national discourse about all of these toxic behaviors that tend to come from females. That would be decried as an exercise in the patriarchy, as demeaning and derogatory and painting with too broad of a brush. But we can do that when we're talking about so-called toxic masculinity, and it's considered to be perfectly fine. And it also seems to me that this notion of trying to have, you know, because even if you make that distinction of, well, we're not talking about all men, we're talking about these certain behaviors that are associated with masculinity that are toxic in nature and should not be a part of acceptable social behavior. And so we're now creating these two categories, which is what is socially acceptable masculinity and socially unacceptable masculinity. It seems to me that you're, by creating that framework, you're setting up a scenario where you get to then define what masculinity should look like and what it means to be a man. In other words, this seems like a kind of an in-round way to try to redefine what it means to be a man and try to redefine masculinity without actually coming at it from the front with your intentions front and center. Now, because if what we want to deal with is people being aggressive in ways that they shouldn't be, engaging in truly inappropriate behavior, then why wouldn't we just address that behavior? Why do we have to associate it with masculinity and with men in particular? And Nathan, you can comment on this as well.
Yeah, I think partially the word toxic masculinity is, I understand it as the toxic parts of what we have come to understand as masculinity. The unique weaknesses of the sort of caricature we've created of a man in our society. In that way, we can have toxic all kinds of things, because everything has these things that the market forces or negative parts of how we sort people result in toxic behaviors that are destructive to ourselves as individuals and destructive to our society at large.
But we tend to talk about toxic behaviors in specific, we tend to individualize them. If we're talking about something like, say, aggression or violence, we talk about aggression and violence. This step of associating it with masculinity, as if aggressive behaviors are something that women never exhibit and that they're somehow immune to, and we don't need to have a conversation about inappropriate behavior from women. It's only men, so we need to laser focus on that. It seems to me to be insincere. It has an air of bad faith about it, that we're not actually concerned about the behaviors as such so much as we are about men and how we think of men and how we define men. Yeah, go ahead.
Sure, but I would say that there's context, right? There's historical context for why we talk specifically about toxic masculinity and maybe not toxic femininity.
Mm-hmm.
I liken it to our discussion around privilege. When we talk about white privilege, or when we talk about male privilege, there's a historical context behind that, right? Because evidence has shown us that white people have benefited more than the general population in some ways, that we live in a patriarchal society, so men have benefited more than women in some ways. And so we have those conversations that are specific to groups of people because we're informed by history and how we got here. So, you know, I think when we talk about toxic masculinity, while at its face it sounds, discriminatory, but there's, you know, some context, some historical context around the behavior of men and how that behavior often differs from that of women, more so around the dynamics of power and physicality and patriarchy. And so I think we can't have the conversation without acknowledging that there is historical context for why we tease out specifically masculinity and maybe not femininity in this conversation. But that doesn't mean that toxic masculinity in and of itself isn't problematic as in the way in which you frame it. And like I said, many people who do the work would agree with you. Most people wouldn't believe that the phrase and the concept of toxic masculinity was in fact presented by men, and not women. And so, it's not necessarily this, you know, rage against, maleness. It's really us, noticing something over time, over history, and then trying to hold ourselves accountable to it. I think one of the things that's also important is that we don't define masculinity as something that's singular, but rather plural. You mentioned about the social constructs and how society has defined masculinity one way, and, you know, masculinity another way. But masculinity in and of itself is a social construct, just like much like race is, right? And so our ideal of masculinity has been defined by society over time. And so there is no correct definition there of masculinity, right? It's really just been what we've been conditioned to believe that masculinity is, from what we wear, to how we behave, to even the jobs that we work. I'm currently speaking at a health disparities conference, and a gentleman today stood up and talked about his career as a nurse, and how he was made fun of because he was a man, growing up, that he wanted to be a nurse. And so, you know, that's an example of toxic masculinity, if you ask me, because we've gendered occupations, we've gendered clothes, we've gendered colors, and then because of that, we say, if you do this kind of job, if you wear this kind of clothing, if you wear this color, if you love other men, then that makes you less than a man. But all of those things are social constructs. So because they are socially constructed, they can very much so be socially deconstructed. And I think that that's what we need to move toward.
All right. That all lays out good groundwork for which we can potentially explore as we go through the rest of the hour here, and I'm interested in doing so. We also have a couple of callers who are interested in weighing in, one of whom's been holding for quite some time. We'll take his call immediately when we return. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Pastor Nathan Roberts in studio. Dr. Ulysses W. Burley III on the line. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk. Believe it or not, you haven't quite broken the record, Joe, for a caller who has held the longest in order to get on the program, but you're very close. You're definitely probably in the top five or so. So we appreciate you doing that. We're going to talk to you here shortly. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We are here 8 to 10 weeknights. Appreciate you being with us. You can join us at 651-989-5855. Brad Omland taking those calls and producing the show in studio. We have Pastor Nathan Roberts on the line. We have Dr. Ulysses W. Burley III. The topic, toxic masculinity. Let's go to Joe in Dresser, Wisconsin. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'll try harder next week. Maybe I can get the record. I have a high school education, so I'm going to simplify this for you. What you're talking about is a jerk. That's what you're referring to. But why I called is I know you've been, or your guests have been, trying to not group people together, keep it separate, but it's always grouped together, and it's just so, I'm so tired of hearing that, you know, I'm a man, I'm toxic. If I'm white, I'm privileged, I'm racist. If I'm straight, cisgendered, I'm homophobic. If I'm Christian, I'm bigoted and Islamophobic. But really, all of these sins are forgivable if you're progressive. That's what it really comes down to, because all those things are forgotten about if you're progressive. And I don't know about the doctor, but if where he is on his faith, but with the pastor, you know, taking on all these issues, what you're really dealing with is fallen man, a sinful man, mankind, not just men. And those things need to be addressed on a spiritual component, not through social justice warriorship, whatever you want to call it. And it, I don't know, it just kind of drives me nuts that that's kind of where the stand is. I'm trying to correct human behavior through human actions instead of a spiritual component.
Well, and I don't even, and we'll get into this with our guest as we continue, Joe, and I appreciate you calling in to offer your thoughts, but I don't even understand what the end game is with these style of conversations, and perhaps we'll come to some better understanding of that than we currently have as we continue with the conversation. Very much appreciate you holding and contributing to the program. Let's hit, and I'll give you guys a chance to respond to these calls once we get through them. Let's go to Pete in Bloomington. Welcome to the program.
Hi. You know, I think it's just another weaponizing of words. And you know, reality is there's this thing called toxic liberalism, and I'll define toxin as something that's dangerous, poisonous, does harmful, doesn't give the desired effect. Often it may look like something else, but in reality it isn't. And I see this as an attack, again, to label people and put people in a box. And I agree with the previous caller. There are people out there who are jerks. But what they're trying to do is say, oh, see, there's this example of the church of this jerk, and we're going to make this in a broad sweeping that this defines anybody who's a conservative, anybody who disagrees with our viewpoint. And that is what I call toxic liberalism, and it's weaponizing words, you know, so they can instantly throw that out there. It's just like calling the president a Nazi, clearly not a Nazi. You know, and you may not agree with them, that's fine, but he isn't a Nazi. And that's what I call toxic liberalism. I'd like to see how he addresses that.
All right, I appreciate the call, Pete. I think the point I take away from Pete's call is that this conversation, regardless of what the intent may be, the nature of it puts people in an inherently defensive place. And is that really, whatever the intention of the conversation is that intention served by placing people in a position where they are closed off and not receptive to whatever it is that you're trying to communicate because they feel as though they're under attack? That's something we'll address as we continue here. But before we do, let's go to John in Minneapolis. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Walter.
Hey.
I agree with the last caller. It's weaponizing a word, and my take on it is I understand how everybody else takes the word toxic masculinity, but I kind of view it more as like when I grew up as a kid, we watched G.I. Joe, Transformers, TV shows where there was a lot of fighting and guns and whatnot in the TV shows. Now you got SpongeBob and Sheldon from Big Bang. I mean, I don't know. That, to me, that's toxic masculinity.
So you're
you want to look at it that way.
You're SpongeBob is toxic masculinity.
That's a unique perspective. So what you're doing is you're reclaiming the term and repurposing it to refer to examples of masculinity that should be avoided.
The drumming of masculinity out of society. Right. That's toxic masculinity.
All right. I appreciate the perspective, John. Thanks for calling into the program. All right. So to put this thing back on the rails and try to reframe some of the thoughts that the callers had there, particularly Joe from Dresser, He articulated well something that I was trying to articulate earlier, which is this notion that it seems like what's really being said here with the concept of toxic masculinity, and, you know, there are other similar concepts, white privilege, what you're really trying to convey, and we had a conversation, Nathan, during the break, wherein, you know, I kind of teased one of the directions I wanted to go with this conversation, which is asking, what's the utility of all this? Like, for somebody like me, what am I supposed to take away from this in terms of how I apply it to my life? What's the prescription? And one of the things I said as I was kind of fleshing that out is, you know, presumably you and I and Dr. Ulysses Burley III, who's on the line with us, are not guilty of these toxic behaviors. And your response was, oh, I very much am. That you are guilty of perpetuating this idea of toxic masculinity in a kind of intentional way, just by virtue of the nature that you are male and part of the male ecosystem. And if that's the case, if we're talking about something kind of like implicit bias or inherent racism in the system, or however it is you want to phrase it, then aren't we basically just saying that we're trying to tell people, we're trying to tell men, there's something wrong with you because you're a man, and there's nothing you can do about it? I mean, how is this a productive course of conversation? Like, where do we go from there that's going to land us someplace where we can be at peace with ourselves and the society we live in?
So I'll give you a personal example. I had a mental health breakdown when I was 23. I was depressed. I was having anxiety, panic attacks, and I couldn't get out of the couch or go to work for several weeks. And I desperately did not want to go seek mental health treatment. I didn't want to talk to anyone about my emotions. I didn't want to tell anyone I wasn't feeling well. And so I just kind of buried it.
Mm-hmm.
And so toxic masculinity in that moment to me were the toxic behaviors that I had been told as a child, don't cry, don't feel depressed, don't have anxiety. And I was bottling them up and they were literally poisoning me and my mental health. Whereas I think if I would have been told at a younger age, hey, you know what? Actually, our family struggles with anxiety. Our family struggles, your genetic code struggles with these kinds of personal mental health challenges. And so you should go talk to a therapist. It's not a punishment. It's not like you failed. Let's go get some tips for how you can effectively stay a productive member of our society. And so for me, it was thinking about, oh, even now I will say it's okay to cry if you feel bad. But when I'm crying at a movie, I'm kind of covering up. I kind of feel embarrassed. There's no reason to feel ashamed for crying at a beautiful film or a wonderful movie. But yet I have this internal shame that I'll be seen as weak in public. And that is a toxic thought that lives inside me because of messages that I received. Although I did love G.I. Joe and Transformers, those characters were not very good at expressing their emotions.
All right, Dr. Burley, we'll come back on the other side of the break and let you expound further, but as concisely as you can in this moment, would you like to tack on to what Nathan's insights were there or respond to any of the points brought up by the callers?
Yeah, sure. So I think, first of all, I'll try to cover as much as I can. So, you know, I am a man of faith and a person of spirituality, but I understand that everyone isn't. And so while spirituality might be a good avenue for addressing, you know, my own male behavior, because I'm a spiritual person, I understand that majority of Americans in particular are nuns, right, who don't exhibit or profess any faith. And so then how do we reach those people through you know, means of kind of these interventions to be able to have these conversations about masculinities. And so while I do agree that it's an issue of sin and there can be a spiritual solution, I also understand that if someone doesn't believe, then perhaps that's not the solution for them. And so as a advocate and health provider, I have to be able to consider the whole, not just my own context. And so that's A. B, you know, when we talk about jerks, yeah, there are jerks who exist. Maybe I was a jerk at some point in my life also. But then there are people who abuse women. There are people who walk into schools and movie theaters and shoot up innocent people. And, like, what do we call them? Are they just jerks when... the vast majority of women don't exhibit that same behavior. So, you know, we have to be able to have a conversation.
Right, but the vast majority of men also don't exhibit that behavior. Just because what you're doing is you're saying, let's look at the group of people who exhibit these behaviors, and if a super majority of them are male, then it's a problem with being male. When in point of fact, the vast majority of every human being on earth doesn't go in and shoot up a theater or act inappropriately with members of the opposite sex. I mean, these are aberrant behaviors that have nothing whatsoever to do with the gender of the people who are engaged in them. There may be disproportionate representation, but that doesn't mean that the behavior itself is a product of being male, or does it?
Yeah, no, I disagree. Can you name me, I don't know how old you are, Walter, but can you name me one female mass shooter in the history of our country?
No, I can't. But that, again, that That does not mean that if you're a man, you're at risk of becoming a mass shooter because you're a man. Or no, does it?
It might not be causation, but there's definitely correlation. So do we ignore that correlation?
So how is this? So here's my question. I'll ask it now, and I'll give you the break to think about it, because I really want a thoughtful response to this. How is that line of reasoning fundamentally different than the racial bigot who says black people act the way they do because they're black? And that we need to address the black community. We need to address the fatherlessness. We need to address the criminality. We need to address the lack of responsibility, the inability to show up to places on time. How is this different than any other type of bigoted assumption about a person based upon a superficial characteristic? 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Toxic masculinity, exhibiting it here tonight to the best of my ability through aggression and combativeness and failure to reconcile. I don't know. I'm assuming that those are aspects of toxic masculinity. I don't know.
They're on the spectrum.
I'm on the spectrum.
Everything's a spectrum with progressives.
Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We are here 8 to 10 weeknights. Appreciate you joining us. The number to contribute, 651-989-5855. Getting a lot of good listener interactions here tonight. Brad Omland taking those calls and producing the show. Pastor Nathan Roberts in studio. On the line, we have Dr. Ulysses W. Burley III. And we've been chatting about toxic masculinity. And, you know, I posed a question at the end of the last segment, and I want to kind of reframe it here, ask the same question in a different way, and get Dr. Burley's response, because it occurs to me that there's a style of argument and a methodological, if that's not the right word, but a method, an approach that's being utilized here in the conversation about toxic masculinity, that if we were to utilize the same approach in targeting any other demographic virtually, with a few exceptions. You might be able to get away talking about white people like this. You might be able to get away talking about cisgendered or straight people like this. But you wouldn't be able to get away to talking about black people like this, or talking about women, or talking about homosexuals, or talking about any other accepted minority victim group in this manner. We've had a conversation with Xavier Bickett, the chair of the Republican Liberty Caucus. You know, we just did an outreach over the weekend at the Minneapolis Urban League to the African-American community. Last year, the RLC held their state convention at the Ardell Farouk Islamic Center in Bloomington, and he caught a lot of flack for that. There is this strain of legitimately bigoted behavior and attitudes that unfortunately is not entirely purged from the Republican Party. And the style of rhetoric that you hear utilized is something along the lines of, you know, the common phrase that we've all heard before, perhaps we've even utilized it from time to time, is, you know, it's true that not all the Muslims are terrorists, but all the terrorists are Muslims, right? Now, what I'm hearing tonight is that a variation of that same premise, that not all men go into a theater and shoot it up, or go into a school and commit a mass shooting, but all of the mass shooters have been men.
False.
So we need to have a conversation about toxic masculinity, Brad.
Ken from Shoreview called it to tell us that the San Bernardino shooter was a woman.
Okay, well, there you go. So a statistical aberration, which doesn't negate the point that I'm drawing here. So, Dr. Burley, your response to that. Why is that a flawed comparison?
Well, first of all, the San Bernardino shooter was two people. One of them was a man, and he was accompanied by a woman. So let's clarify.
Okay.
And that's actually a good segue into why the comparison doesn't hold weight. That's because one of them is actually verified by facts. And so when you say all Muslims aren't terrorists, but all the terrorists are Muslims, well, that's just not true, right? And we can prove that that's not true. But up until now, like I said, we still haven't, nobody's been able to produce to me the name of a woman who, and I just use that as an example. Here's another example. Last year, the United Nations produced a report that said the most dangerous place for women in the world is in their home with their partners. That's a fact. And so that means that most women on earth are killed by an intimate partner that they live in the home with. And those partners are overwhelmingly men. And so, again, I am a public health expert. I'm a clinician. I'm an epidemiologist. Everything that we do is on the basis of trends. Everything that we do is on the basis of looking at these aggregate groups, looking at these majorities, and then seeing how it is that we can impact these majorities. And so I operate on factual statistics, and I don't have the luxury of dismissing, majority of men are not, quote-unquote, toxic. I don't consider myself to be so. Have I had some toxic behavior? Do I exhibit some? Sure. Are all men toxic? Absolutely not.
Well, and that's something worth exploring. I mean, the thinking of it in terms of, quote-unquote, toxic masculinity, as opposed to what I would deem the more appropriate alternative, which is toxic behavior. You know, I'm a father of two boys. Mm-hmm. And do they engage in toxic behaviors? Absolutely, all the time. That's right. And my job as a parent is to correct that behavior. However, if I were to think of it and promote their thinking of it in terms of a part of their identity, that the reason why they behave this way is because of who they are, isn't that a tremendous handicap to their ability to exhibit better behaviors and to shed their inappropriate behaviors?
I would say that often those behaviors are a product of who they are told that they ought to be rather than who they are.
I agree.
So the one caller brought up G.I. Joe and Transformers, and as much fun as those shows are to watch, there are some specific behaviors that are lifted up as pro male behaviors in those shows. Fighting it out, joining the army. And I think that these sort of tendencies towards violence and a great example is there was a really robust conversation after the locker room talk incident where there was a lot of people who said grab women against their will and they mm-hmm. let you do it is locker room talk. And there, I had a significant number of conversations with older men who said, yeah, they'd heard a lot of comments like that in the locker room.
Mm-hmm.
And so if that kind of talk is existing in the locker room, that is emblematic of a culture that is allowing aggressive, toxic behaviors to permeate in a male-only space. And that is why I would refer to it as a part of toxic masculinity. Not that it applies to everyone, but there is a cultural sense in which, another phrase is, boys will be boys.
Yeah, and let me say this. It applies to women, too. And so, Walter, you mentioned you have two boys. I have two girls. And a part of my role as a parent is to exhibit behavior as a man that I would want my girls to accept from other men.
Mm-hmm.
And so, personal experience. Years ago, much younger man, when I was dating, I remember dating a woman who said that she didn't feel comfortable being with me because she felt like I couldn't protect her like the other men that she had dated because I was a nice guy, because I was non-confrontational, because I tried to diffuse things rather than escalate things. And for that reason, it did not make her feel safe, and she wants to feel like her man can protect her. It didn't account that I had trained martial arts my entire childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And if that was the issue, it just accounted for my demeanor. Oh, you're too nice. You're too non-confrontational. And so I would say that that was an exhibit of toxic masculinity on her behalf because she had been taught that masculinity is supposed to be one way, and that's the way that she wanted it, and that's the way that she was accepting it. Another example with someone who I used to date. We would get into an argument. I'm not the kind of person that raises my voice or anything like that.
And I was in a relationship with someone who was. And I remember her yelling at me and saying, yell at me, curse at me, do something so that I know that you care. And
this is not an experience that I've had.
That to me was an example of toxic masculinity.
Sure, no, I hear you.
She had been trained and taught that men should be loud and aggressive and demeaning, especially when arguing. And she didn't know what to do with my response, which was counter to that. And so, you know, I want to be clear that this is not something that men just perpetuate. Like, this is something that we've been conditioned as a society that is a much, larger conversation around patriarchy. That I think we have to all work to kind of deconstruct.
All right, that's a fascinating angle. We're going to have to leave it there. We're late for a break. We'll take some calls when we return. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. City's News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Not a lot of time. Let's try to shoehorn in some calls here. Bring back up Dr. Ulysses Burley III. We also have Pastor Nathan Roberts in studio. My name's Walter Hudson. Let's talk to Jordan in Robbinsdale. Welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. You know, the thing about the females is, look, man, there's plenty of evidence for females that have committed mass murder. Tashfeen Malik, San Bernardino shooter, 14 killed. Jennifer San Marco, Goleta post office shooting, 6 killed. Brenda Spencer, Cleveland Elementary School. Amy Bishop, University of Alabama. There's tons of them. So the whole myth of it being related to masculinity, it doesn't hold true. It really holds true that it is an aberration of people in general. So I agree with Walter on that.
All right, I appreciate the call, Jordan. Let's talk to Phil in Lakeville. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This whole toxic masculinity discussion strikes me as just toxic feminism that's been repackaged. It's toxic males, all men are evil, all women are victims. Even the doctor's examples of women's behavior and their attitudes towards him was somehow a man's fault. It's all men are evil, women are victims, and everything about men is bad. It's just the new feminism.
All right, I appreciate the thought, Phil. Thanks for calling. We don't have a whole lot of time left. I do want to say we've already made plans to have Dr. Burley back at some future date to go into more depth on a broader range of issues related to men's mental health. I think that'll be a fascinating conversation. We've had some good prototypes of that during the breaks here. Real quickly, Dr. Burley, I want to get your take on what the utility of this conversation is. Like, what should men take away from the conversation that we've had tonight?
Sure. Frederick Douglass said that it is easier to build strong children than to repair broken men. And so in that vein, I just want us to build up a generation that thinks differently about social constructs, whether it's race, or gender, or masculinity, or femininity. And that whatever those constructs are, if they're not loving, if they're not empathetic, if they're not graceful, and if they're not liberating, just allowing people to exist in them, in their natural selves, that don't hurt other people, then we should probably reject them.
All right, appreciate it very much. We'll talk at a future date. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
From the Chris Lindahl Real Estate Studios, Twin Cities News Talk, KTLK AM, Minneapolis.
KT7 APP Cottage Grove.